Hello, welcome to Kitchen Curiosity, the podcast that delves into the heart of food service equipment and the hospitality sector. I'm here today in London at Canary Wharf, back in our studios again, I think third week running. I've got Lewis Bruce from Foster and Gamco. Lewis, welcome to the show.
Hi Radford, nice to see you.
Good to see you. I think a lot of people in the UK will know you anyway, but we'll get into introducing you properly. And Ewan Hunter from Corsica with us as well in the studio. How are you? Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here, Radford.
Great. Well, yeah, thank you both for joining me. And obviously, today we're going to be talking about Cedar Bond, as this is a Cedar Bond sponsored podcast, but also talking about your businesses and a little bit into sort of project business and what that looks like for you. And obviously as well, HRC coming up at the end of the month. So Lewis, if you don't mind kicking us off, what brought you into food service equipment?
Well, I guess there's no shame in saying that I fell into the industry like many people have. Around about 10 years ago, a good friend of mine brought to me an opportunity that there was a vacancy at Foster and Gamco. At the time, I was working in procurement, so I was the other side of the table in terms of sales.
Not in our sector, though?
Not in our industry, no. So totally out of the industry. Had a little bit of sales experience from, you know, a few years ago working in retail and talking to people about, you know, shoes and clothes and stuff. But yeah, at the time, Foster and Gamco had a really experienced sales team. I think most of the team would have had at least 10 years experience. Mm-hmm. So at that time, they were prepared to look at somebody perhaps without the experience, train them up. And fortunately, I interviewed and was given the job. So yeah, wow. that was 10 years ago. And here I am now, and enjoyed every moment of it.
Okay. And so you've enjoyed that change. Was it retail from before? Was that the sort of sector? Or?
Well, no. I mean, my procurement role kind of oddly was for the professional body of buyers. It's called SIPS, which is Chartered Institute of Procurement and Suppliers. So I was doing the procurement for them as an organisation. But prior to that, I had a few sales roles at the weekend when I was at school, you know, John Lewis and Sports Direct and, you know, all those sort of places. So I had a little bit of experience of, you know, dealing with customers face to face. But in terms of my first professional sales role, it would be with Foster and Gamco.
And you've been with, so really in our sector, 10 years with the same company.
Yes,
which
indeed.
That's quite an achievement in itself, really,
well,
isn't it?
Yeah, you would think 10 years is a long time, but I think one thing I've seen from our industry is there's so much experience. You know, the amount of people that have done 30 years plus, 40 years plus. I remember when I first started at Foster and Gamco, around about a month in, I think there was four or five people who were celebrating 45 years of service at Foster and Gamco at the same time.
Right, okay.
So I was really quite amazed at, wow, this must be a really good industry for people to work that, you know, for that amount of years. And, you know, and like I say, fast forward 10 years, I really get that. It's a really fun industry. Hospitality is everywhere. And, you know, Foster and Gamco is a great place to work. So, I hope for another 10 years.
And I guess in your role, it's quite technical at points as well. So that experience and knowledge, it's not easily learnt.
No. I remember the first week, there was a bit of an introduction to the business. And then it was, here's some car keys, jump in the pool car that had done 300,000 miles and go and see your customers and go and introduce yourself. And, you know, it's a great way to learn, you know, get thrown in the deep end. Go and talk to people, you know, two ears and one mouth kind of approach, a lot of listening, understanding. And, you know, from there, you quickly understand what it's about, understand the customer's needs. And, you know, it's a great way to really start in the industry.
Yeah, definitely. And then if you don't mind me asking, like, we rewind back before that, where were you brought up? Like, where's, like, originally child home for
you?
So
I was born and raised in Peterborough in Cambridgeshire. So it's actually only about an hour's drive from King's Lynn, where Foster and Gamco is based. I did spend a few years up in the northeast as a student, which was great fun. Newcastle is a great city. I'm a Newcastle fan, so I had a very enjoyable few years up there. But I had to come home. All the partying had taken its toll, and time to settle down and enter the real world of you know, paying taxes and working.
And now you're back in that same area, are you?
Yeah. I'm settled in Peterborough. I've got a young family, three boys. Yeah. I've been married for 10 years this year, so it's a year of 10 year anniversaries. So I'm very settled there. My role takes me across the country. It's a national projects role, supporting consultants, distributors that do project work. So I get to see all parts of the UK. But home for me is Peterborough. I do go into King's Lynn a fair bit, where we're based.
Yeah.
So I also spend a lot of time there. Obviously, London, being as big as it is, a lot of projects go into London. So I do spend a lot of time in and around London. And I've slowly learned how the tubes work and which line takes you where.
Yeah.
So, you know, every day's a school day and I'm learning every day.
And a question I ask quite a lot of guests as well is like, I know you're not that old, just real young, really, in human years.
Well, I'm 40 like. This year. Next year. Sorry.
Oh, well, you're looking amazing for it. A younger you, when you were like 16, what would you tell your 16-year-old self now? Like, what if you could tell
them? Yeah, it's a difficult one, really. I mean, I guess, like many people, I never really had a defined idea on what I wanted to do at that point. I started to think about going into teaching at that sort of time because outside of...
You look like a teacher. I don't know if that's a positive thing.
Well, thank you. I suppose most teachers are friendly. You do get the odd dragon teacher. But no, you know, growing up, I played a lot of sport and I got involved in some coaching and I really kind of enjoyed that, you know, coaching and educating people. And I thought teaching would be possibly a career for me, but... just never really materialized, to be honest. I can't really work out why, but you know, eventually you have to get a job, you've got to start working. Had the usual kind of jobs, trying to figure out what I wanted to do, you know, unloading lorries and working in a call center. But then like I say, a great friend of mine just came to me with an opportunity to, you know, just to take a jump in the deep end, really, going to sales. I was working in an office every day, you know, a little bit mundane at times, the usual 9 to 5. But yeah, the opportunity came around and I thought, why not?
Yeah.
And I have no regrets.
Okay.
It's been great fun.
Well, thank you for that. I'm going to come back to you, of course, and talk about a bit more about your role and Foster Gamco and obviously the wider group that you work with. Ewan, again, welcome to the show and thank you for joining me. Same sort of questions to you, really. Like, how did you get into this sector?
Mine was slightly different to Lewis. So I studied industrial design at university. So I wanted to be a product designer.
Okay.
Always very interested in art and design and technology as a child. So seemed like a logical thing to do would be to go on to university and do that. So I did it at Napier University in Edinburgh.
Okay.
And it just so happened that as I'd come to the end of my course, Falcon Food Service Equipment placed an advert for industrial designer, which was quite an unusual job. Especially, you know, grew up in Falkirk. The factory at the time was in Larbert. It was only a few miles away from where I was living, and I thought, this is perfect. So I applied for it.
What a coincidence, what a dream.
I know, it was incredible. So I applied for it, and I was fortunate enough to be given the opportunity to join the company, and it kind of went from there. So,
okay. How long were you with Falcon for?
13 years.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, so kind of starting off doing design, so there was a lot of projects that we worked on.
Yeah.
And it was really nice because I was the only industrial designer there, so the only person doing sort of creative design, but working with the R&D teams and then the engineering designers.
Yeah.
And gave me a massive amount of exposure to that process because it was so close to the factory floor as well. There was a lot of time spent there looking at the products, learning about the manufacturing processes, and really a great opportunity to put into practice all of the things that I'd learnt throughout my course in quite a quick period of time. And that led on to opportunities to work with some of the other companies within, at the time, Agri Food Service Group.
Yeah.
So I did some projects on domestic products and then some of the other commercial companies in America.
Okay.
And it was just, it was a great time. Great time.
And then you moved over to your current role, or went, there was a change in between? Or?
There was a little bit in between. So was at Falcon for 13 years, as I say, initially doing design work, and then that sort of merged into more marketing and brand management. So looking after literature and exhibition stands, one of which was the stands at the old Hotel Olympia, which is now HRC. Mm-hmm. So that was great fun as well. But then I met my wife, one of those old stories, you know, you meet someone. She lived in Manchester, so... I moved to Manchester.
Okay.
And then I was fortunate enough to get a job and a sales position for a wholesaler called Axon Enterprises. So, and again, that was the first, you know, Lewis was saying about his first kind of sales role. That was my first,
your first
sales role. Yeah, yeah. As such, I'd been previously used to selling concepts and ideas part of that kind of creative process, much as you would as well. You know, you've got to do stand up and do a presentation in front of your client. Well, I had to do it in front of the board. And
Of course. So yours is more of a kind of almost a structured approach into the industry. If I don't know if that's fair to say, but some of us just kind of fall into it. Like
yeah,
really, you know.
I hadn't set out to be
in that industry, but
I wanted to be in the design side of things. So I had the opportunity to work at Axon, and that was really interesting because it gave me more exposure to distributors.
Yes.
Whereas in the past, I might have done work for distributors through the sales team. I hadn't actually been a salesperson. And I often say that I wish I'd in some ways done it the opposite way around, because the things I've learned about how the challenges for distributors and salespeople for manufacturers, if I'd known a lot of that, it would have made me much better at my job in the first place.
But I suppose you come from quite a technical position
That's the way things are. So I stayed at Axon for 2 years and then got the opportunity to move to E&R Moffat.
Yeah, yes.
And that was just prior to the free school meals.
Okay, yeah.
Coming out, they were quite heavily into public sector, HCA and LESA. So that was a really busy time going out. And again, the first time I'd really done any bespoke products. So it was a lot of, you know, site visits for bespoke counters and fabrication and things.
Okay.
So again, looking back on what you said about every day is a school day, it's always about learning something new. And I think that's the interesting thing about the industry as well, that there's always a new challenge and something to find out. So again, I was there for nearly 5 years and then moved to Parry.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that move...
Which is probably where I know you from, yeah.
Probably, yeah.
Remember, yeah.
So primarily that was because they were looking for someone that could do a bit of sales but also help them with their new product development process.
Okay.
So my old background sort of came into play from that point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And we did some great products there in the time that I was there, developing them. So working very closely again with the R&D team.
And a lot manufactured engineers. Actually here in the UK, isn't there, those products at Parry?
They are, yeah, that's right. Built, manufactured in Derby.
Yeah.
So
I've seen that factory. It's pretty impressive, actually.
It is, yeah. It's a nice, a lovely company. So again, I was there for 7 years, so everything's been a reasonable amount of time. I don't really like change. I wear the same hooded top that I've had for 12 years when I'm at home. Quite stable from that point of view, but an opportunity came up with Kasiga, and I'd known Kasiga whilst I was working with Parry, because we did a lot of counter projects, but we didn't make drop-ins.
Right, okay.
So we bought the drop-ins from Kasiga to put into the counter projects. So I'd known them for a long time, loved the products. The customer service was amazing, and it was just a really nice company. So
how long have you been with them now, Kasiga?
Since the 12th of January.
Okay, so it's
just a couple of months.
Right,
yeah.
Okay.
So I'm still kind of...
You've been quite active then.
Yeah. But in at the deep end, trying to learn more about the products and the customer base is slightly different as well. So, yeah, it's been
You were brought up in Edinburgh area, you said?
I was brought up in Falkirk.
Oh, Falkirk. Okay, so...
But actually born in Gibraltar, which not a lot of people know. Yeah, my dad was in the army, so he travelled around a bit.
Right.
I was fortunate enough to be born in Gibraltar. But then
and then you had to move around with...
Yeah, well, dad subsequently came out of the army.
Right.
I was the youngest of four children, so
okay.
I think we came back when I was about two.
Right,
back
okay,
to
and
Scotland.
Then went back to Scotland.
Yeah,
yeah. So, I mean, that's undergone quite a lot of change in Edinburgh now. You know, like it's as a city.
Yeah, I mean, studying there was great. To be honest, I really loved it, and it's a great place to go back to. It's often very cold and wet and windy, but if you can put up with that, there's a lot going on. The festival season's brilliant.
Yeah.
In the summer, if you can get up for that, yeah.
Definitely.
Great place to be.
I love Edinburgh. I think it's a beautiful city.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you for that. So, yeah, Lewis, you work for Foster & Gamco, but it's part of a wider group. So just for the listeners, I know that it's a well-known brand, but what is it? What do you do?
Foster & Gamco, we're both manufacturers of commercial refrigeration.
Okay.
Foster is food refrigeration, Gamco being more bottles, drinks, bar refrigeration.
Okay.
And we're both part of the ITW Group, which is a huge, diverse manufacturing business based in America. And also part of that group is Hobart as well. So
another big brand people would know.
Absolutely. And there are other brands as well throughout Europe. And we're part of the food equipment group of ITW.
Okay.
And there are other divisions. I remember a phrase along the lines of you're never too far away from a ITW product.
Okay.
So they have an automotive division, construction products.
Oh, right,
so
okay.
A real diverse manufacturing business.
Right, okay. All kind of manufacturing, but... but different sectors.
Yeah, industrial manufacturing. So we do, as I say, automotive, construction, chemicals, polymers. Yeah, really diverse. But it's all the principles can be applied to all the businesses. A lot of lean manufacturing, an 80-20 principle of working. You know, we like to support our 80 customers. That's our focus, and also developing products that will sell a lot of. That's the kind of ethos within the business.
Yeah. And manufacture, a lot of it's still manufactured in Kings Lynn, is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. So we manufacture in Kings Lynn for Foster products. Gamco is manufactured in the Netherlands, a place called Etten-Leur, so not too far away from the UK.
Yeah.
And we do have a manufacturing facility in France as well, which manufactures one or two products. But yes, predominantly UK for Foster, and also within the Netherlands for Gamco.
And then your role, I mean, your project sales manager, is that right?
So my job title is projects business manager. So when I first started, I was a regional business manager, which basically covering an area of distributors. So you might have 200-300 distributors within your territory, and your role is to support them, educate them, and get them promoting Foster products. But the projects role, I have a lot less dealers, but these are big businesses, big kitchen houses, and also the main consultants in the UK. And the role is really about supporting, educating consultants on our products, educating them on what our products do, how they solve customer pain points, and educating dealers as well, because some of the dealers do deliver the consultant projects, but then they'll do their own projects in-house as well. So for me, the role is really, it's an educational role. I don't see it as really a selling role.
Supporting
and it's supporting.
Helping specify.
My sort of view is that, dealers are really an extension of our sales team.
Yeah.
They're the ones selling to the end users, and our job is to help them in selling our features and benefits to them. And we do that through education, lunch and learn sessions, et cetera, So that's kind of my role in a nutshell. Part of it as well does include Foster Cold Stores.
Okay.
So Foster Cold Stores isn't part of the ITW group.
Right, okay.
But we do represent them from a selling perspective.
Right, okay.
And
they deliver the product, if you like.
Yeah, so they manufacture the panels in Kings Lynn as well. They're on the same industrial facility, manufacturing facility, sorry. And, cold rooms are probably a bit more technical. They're more of a construction product.
Yeah.
Most cold rooms tend to be different on each project. So there's probably a little bit more involved in terms of technical support for consultants. But of course, we are seeing, big sustainability drive within UK construction at the moment. So, on the Foster and Gamco side, we are providing a lot of technical information related to sustainability.
And so I'm going to come on to that sustainability, but what innovations are you kind of seeing in refrigeration, or what are you guys doing in terms of innovation at the moment?
I think great innovation is really about solving problems. It's understanding the customer, the operator, understanding what's causing them pain, or where could you make improvements to their operations. That's what great innovation is. And we do it in a couple of ways, really. For example, we have a team of key account managers, and their job is to get really, really close to, some of the big chains and businesses within the UK, get really close to them, understand their operation. And from that, we can then create products for them
that
suits their operation, that saves them time, saves them on costs and labor costs, etc. But then we also, a great example of innovation from us is our Stay Clear condensing unit, which we introduced almost 10 years ago now.
Okay.
And that is ultimately the solution to a very common problem with refrigeration, is that the condensing units, traditional condensing units, will get blocked over time.
With dust and
debris and food particles. And once a condensed unit is blocked, then the risk of breakdowns goes up significantly. Energy usage goes up. And that can be a real problem for operators, because they have to have it regularly cleaned, which is a cost. And also, we probably know that it doesn't happen as frequently as it should. And like I said, around 10 years ago, our warranty data was telling us that this is a real problem. So we looked at different options and eventually developed our Stay Clear, which in a nutshell doesn't get blocked.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, it's a uniquely designed condensing unit, doesn't have the same narrow fins. And yeah, since we've introduced it, we've almost eliminated
those issues.
Those issues, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. I think we've eliminated 90% of condense related call outs.
So that extends product lifetime, I guess reduces energy and.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, we're, you know, extending the life of products, we're reducing the risk of breakdowns, which is ultimately downtime for the operator, it's cost of repairs. And for me, that's great innovation. But it was launched 10 years ago, and in that time, we're still developing that stay clear. You know, we've got new versions of it that are improved, that are bringing even more improvements on energy. So it's not always about inventing new products. It's really about understanding what causes operators' problems and trying to find solutions to them. So yeah, there's a couple of examples for you.
And then, I mean, I've just done a big piece on sustainability in the podcast, but what sort of things are you doing around that sustainability piece, you know, in your business? Really?
You know, we've absolutely seen a lot more requests for information on sustainability. I mean, sustainability is one of those words that can mean different things to different people. But, you know, at an organisational level, at Foster and Gamco, you know, we are tackling our own emissions output, and we are part of SBTI, which is a science-based targets initiative.
Okay.
Which basically means that we've had, you know, an assessment done of our current emissions, where they come from, and we've got some targets in place to reduce those as an organisation, which has been approved by the SBTI. They're publicly published data, so it gives us credibility that we've got a, you know, robust plan to reduce our own carbon emissions as a business, which is a good thing, because we know there's issues with climate at the moment, and it's a collective effort, isn't it? It's not going to be the responsibility of one or two countries. It's going to be globally everybody doing their bit. But then at a product level, this is where we're seeing quests for things like TM65s, which is basically telling you what the carbon, what the CO2 equivalent is to manufacture that product. Mm-hmm. And we've put a lot of effort into getting the data needed from our supply chain to then start producing these reports that are being asked for from big construction companies. And it filters through the consultants, through to the dealers, and then it comes through to us manufacturers to produce this information. So it's not everywhere, to be honest. I feel like it has started mainly within projects and construction.
Yeah.
Will likely start coming through more from blue chip companies who are addressing their carbon footprint and their own sustainability goals. So yeah, it's probably hit me first in our business. And I believe we're in a good place, you know, to support and support those who need the information.
And we just covered a huge piece on that TM65 in the last episode. And we had sustainability manager on from Grat Brothers Group.
Yes.
Alice. So we went into quite a lot of detail about that. So so to you and from your perspective, where does your brand sit in the market now? What does it do? And
So if for anybody that doesn't know Casiga, so we manufacture heated and refrigerated and ambient food displays. So our kind of key message is that we help operators make food look great. So we're focused more on the display of the product as opposed to the product themselves. And I think that's what I find interesting as well, because often people don't want to buy a product. It's a kind of solution to a problem they need. They don't want a fridge. They want to keep food cold, and they want to keep food cold because they want it to stay fresh, and it's fresh so they can sell it. So it's looking beyond, I think, the product and trying to find out what they do. So we're based in New Zealand.
Okay.
So
manufactured there?
Headquartered in New Zealand, but actually manufactured in China. Okay. So we've got a joint initiative with a company in China. So they manufacture all of our products. Bigger in Australia than they are in the UK,
okay,
which is quite interesting. So the market there is slightly different as well. So it tends to be large rollouts. So we might sell into a lot of the sort of mining welfare kind of stations where people will go. I suppose it's the equivalent of catering for offshore in oil, but it's for mining in Australia. So a lot of the orders that they get are very much bulk orders for products, whereas ours...
And I guess as well, because their geographical location, maybe that was their start market or I don't know.
That's it, yeah, absolutely. So they started off in New Zealand and then sort of spread to Australia, but then saw an opportunity 10 years ago to come to the UK,
yeah,
and they've done really well in the UK so far. but it tends to have been more with sort of shop fitters and people like that. So the distributor, the sort of traditional distributor market, doesn't know the brand so well. And that's where we see a real opportunity.
That retail shop fitter arm, not necessarily what we would know as our kitchen distributors.
Yes, that's right.
And so when you talk about drop-in products, what you talk about, like cold wells, heated, what are you talking about?
So it's a mix. So we do a lot of freestanding displays, so heated and chilled multi-decks.
Okay, like grab-and-go units. Grab-and-go kind of units, thing.
That's right. So very popular in coffee shops and delis and places like that. So
that can be boxed in, or it can be freestanding? Or
A bit of both, to be honest, yeah. So we're quite flexible in terms of the ventilation on the refrigeration, which means a lot of our products will just push into a recess in a counter. A lot of them are shop fitted or fabricated with a recess behind, but you don't need to put any venting on the front of the counter, which maintains a nice clean look. Rather than having a big sort of stainless steel grill across the front of the tiled fascia.
That's a massive selling point. Really.
So it's really good, and it makes them almost look like they're dropped in units, but it gives you the benefit of, obviously no one wants anything to go wrong, but things do go wrong.
Yeah.
So it means you can just roll the products back out again. So we have a couple of ranges of those, sort of high capacity ones, and then shorter ones, which are more sort of serve over that you might see in some of the high street coffee shops. I'm not sure if I'm allowed to name brands, but probably start seeing them as you go around. And then we do more traditional drop-in units as well.
Okay.
So refrigerated wells, bain-maries, saran tops, things like that as well.
So historically in the UK, it's been more, so the shop fitters, that kind of thing.
That's right.
Is it really since you've come on board, or is it before that that they've started looking more what we would know as our distribution market?
So they did start working with distributors prior to that, prior to me joining. But one of the things I found really interesting about it was when I mentioned to people that we were using Casiga products when I was at Parry, lots of people had never heard of them.
That's really strange. Until you contacted me, and I was like, "Okay, what's this?"
Because there's such lovely products. Yeah. They really focus on the food display, and provide an excellent solution for people across a wide range of applications. So I was quite surprised, and this maybe goes on to education for distributors. But I was surprised that not more people were familiar with them. So I thought that's a great opportunity for me to
introduce them. And I mean, already you mentioned one benefit there, not having to have that grill at the front, which is quite attractive for most people, especially if you're in a corporate setting. They don't want that. They want it all flush, everything clean.
Definitely, And there's other features built in to make it easier to clean condensers, because we identified that as a problem. I think it's a common problem in the industry, isn't it? Yeah. That people put things in and then just forget about them, so they don't clean them. So we've built in features to make it easier to do that. And then for the enclosed displays, we've got a tilting front so people can get in, clean and change ticket strips and things more easily, but in a safe manner. So there's lots of nice little features that are built in to make it more operationally friendly.
Yeah.
And again, from my design background, I love all these little details that you don't really know until you get the benefit from them.
Of course. And I mean, what a customer's looking for in food display, hot, cold, whatever, grab and go, whatever it is, now compared to say pre-COVID, or is it the same?
I think to some degree it is the same. I think what we're seeing is a request for more capacity, so people want to be able to hold more product for longer periods of time. So we're working with someone just now through distributor, and one of the problems they've got is that the existing cabinets that they buy, they don't have a huge capacity in them, and the holding time for their product's not very long. So what they're finding is they can only hold it for maybe 45 minutes, and then they're having to, if it doesn't sell, they're having to take it out.
It's not long bag at all, really.
It's not long at all, no. Especially during quiet periods. I think when they're busy, they've got quite a good turnaround of product, but when they're not busy, then they're finding they're having to take it out, bag it up, and then sell it as too good to waste. But they're selling at a discount, so they have a lot of wastage from that point of view. So we're talking to them about sort of higher capacity units, which have got a longer holding time, which might be up to maybe 4 hours.
Yeah.
Which means if they've got less staff, they don't have to load it as often, but they can load it with more product, which means it looks fuller. So it's more attractive from a customer's point of view. If you see a display
and
it's full of product, it makes you want to buy it.
You're right,
because
if you see one with just one or two in there,
if you go past somewhere and there's like a single pie sitting on its own, you start to wonder how long it's been there. So yeah, talking to people about things like that and the benefits from it, but also I guess trying to tailor some of the products. So we don't make bespoke products, but we can, if there's a volume there, make a product tweak for a customer.
Okay.
And do some local modifications as well in Speak.
Okay. All right, well, thank you for that. We're going to just take a short break and then we're going to come back and discuss a little bit about kind of project business, industry discussion, and obviously Cedar Bond as well.
This episode is brought to you by Cedar Bond, a UK buying and marketing consortium for the food service equipment sector. For decades, Cedar Bond has connected dealers, suppliers and partners to drive value, collaboration and long-term success across the industry. Cedar Bond is proud to be part of HRC 2026, the UK's flagship hospitality and food service show, taking place from the 30th of March to the 1st of April 2026 at XL London. Don't miss the brand new Cedar Bond Village, a vibrant hub bringing the Cedar Bond community together right at the heart of HRC. To find out more, visit hrc.co.uk.
Yeah, welcome back. So now we're going to discuss about project business, Cedar Bond, HRC, a little bit about our industry and some fun questions as well. So from your perspectives, you know, if we talk about project business, and I know that project business is different for each of you, it's different. But what are the big challenges around delivering, like, equipment, large projects?
Well, I think, I think what we've seen in the last couple of years is some challenges around delays on projects. So we might...
As in on-site?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, on-site. So we might receive an order for some equipment that is required on this date here. So we would manufacture to that date. And then potentially a week or two before, when the products are ready to go, they might
Engineers are booked in.
Yeah. They might then say, sorry, there's delays on-site. We need to push it back 3 months or whatever it might be. And then ultimately we're then storing equipment in the warehouse for long periods of time. You know, and listen, we're empathetic. We know it's these things happen, you know, and it's no one's fault particularly, is it? You know, it's just the challenges of construction at the moment. But yeah, of course, you know, we do have warehousing facilities and we can do this sort of stuff. But of course, we want to make things and ship out the door. And
of course, and of course, you need, you know, a few of those, and suddenly you've got warehouses starting to fill up.
Yeah, indeed, and you know, and of course, you know, you want to provide some accurate forecasts around orders and revenue, and sometimes that can, you know, throw a sort of spanner in the works, if you like, you know, to say that this project's been delayed and okay, well, you know, we were hoping to see that this month or this quarter. But I'd say certainly that for the last 2 years, it does seem that has been
the biggest challenge.
I think so. Yeah.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think, you know, I think, you know, from a cold room perspective, cold rooms often get on site earlier because they are often part of the build, the construction. So they're on site, whereas Foster and Gamco cabinets are often the last thing that goes in. And there's enough things that can happen on a construction site that can cause delays.
Yeah.
You know, it could be to do with labour shortages. It could be to do with supply issues that are holding things up. As I say, we're often the last thing to go in, and you know, we often find these delays come our way.
Yeah, because you're at the back end of the project, so things have happened, whatever's happened along the way.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I'd say at the moment that seems to be one of the main challenges.
One of the big challenges, And your experience with projects of that kind?
Yeah, I think the same thing as well. Just it's the sort of challenge of kind of managing both ways, because I've, you know, worked on a lot of projects in the past where the main contractor or distributor said, you know, this counter has to be on site on this day, this bar has to be on site on this day, and you're working back from a delivery date to a manufacturing date to a drawing sign off date, but you've got to do the final sizes at some point. And you try to get to site to get the final sizes, and you might travel quite a long distance and then discover that there's no plasterboard on the wall, there's no access to the site.
Yeah.
But yet the time frames are getting squeezed and squeezed. So I think certainly with big projects, I think it tends to be that the kitchen equipment on a big build tends to get left to last, and then that's what really gets squeezed.
Yeah.
And then obviously delays as well. So where people might need something installed, the site's not quite ready, the engineers turn up and they can't get access because the floor's just been screeded, and then the customer might say, well, it's okay, it'll be ready, this is Tuesday, it'll be ready on Friday, but actually the engineers have got more work booked in for the next 2 or 3 weeks, but the customer expects you just to you know, come immediately back to site, and it's quite difficult in terms of managing that process,
that expectation as well. And of course because resources are finite, so engineers are scheduled, and then if there's a cog in the works, that can cause problems.
That's it.
But from your perspective now, because you're not doing like projects traditionally is what we would consider, but I guess you are doing some sort of projects.
Yeah, so we sort of categorise it, Casiga, if it's individual displays, 2 or 3 on an order, it's just regarded as being an order. But if it's anything more than that, so it's maybe like 5+, we call it an oversized project because it might need some management.
Yes.
Or if it's something where we're tailoring a product for a customer, so it might be a rollout where all of the units have got to come in, they've got to be wrapped, or we've got to change the shelves on them. So although we don't make bespoke products from the factory, when they come into our place in Speak, we do a lot of modifications to them depending on what customers want. So there's a certain degree of tailorization that we can do, and it's just again planning that out, because depending on the size of the project, if it's a small project, people just want things immediately, and it's amazing, you'll know yourself, I'm sure, what people leave to the last minute when they're opening a bakery or a coffee shop and they forget that they actually need equipment in there. So there's a lot of that. Then the medium-sized projects, which tend to be, we might get a drawing, and it could be from a consultant or from a distributor, and they're saying, well, we've got this display in here. It might be pre-specified, but sometimes it'll just be, you know, there's a chilled multi-deck or a heated grab-and-go unit. We don't need it until 2028. Can you give us a price for 2028? And that's quite a tricky thing to do as well, because they're tendering for it. But no one knows what's going to happen, especially the way the world is at the moment.
Exactly.
No one knows, you know, what's going on. And then we've got the big rollout ones, so they've got, again, their own challenges. So it might be that we're getting an order for container loads of product, which will go straight, it'll bypass Speak, it'll go straight from the factory into the distributor, and then they'll consolidate it and spread it across all the sites they've got over a 6-month period maybe. So there's, you know, there are delays sometimes in getting things. Things don't always work out. So it's just that constant management. But I also always find, with any of these things, someone once said to me, no one likes bad news, but they like surprises even less. So if you just keep that kind of communication going, totally. I think that's the key thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And everyone understands that sometimes things
I think don't. That's a really good bit of advice, just sometimes just telling people that
be honest
before they find out
absolutely.
Can take the wind out of the sail, so to speak.
Try and give them as much forward warning as possible, and I think that's what we would ask from our customers as well, our distributors, if you know something's not going to fall when you expect it, try and let us know. Don't tell us once it's been dispatched and it's on the way to site.
So, I mean, and I'll ask this question because obviously I know my role, but what makes a good consultant or distributor or, you know, shop fitter to work with?
Yeah, I think from a manufacturer's perspective, it's working collaboratively with the dealer, with the consultant. You know, it's working together. It's sharing information. It's working together to find the right product, you know, for that operator's needs.
Okay.
And to be honest, you know, I do find that the vast majority are very good. You know, very open. You know, they talk to us. They keep communication open, and. You know, for us, that's really important. We like to know what's going on, what's being worked on, and ultimately, how can we help?
Yes.
And how can we make your life easy, and give you the support that you need? So, you know, sometimes we have to be told, you know, well, you haven't got this or you need to have that. And ultimately that makes us get things in place to then make your life and other people's lives much easier.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely. I think building a relationship with them and, you know, people wanting to learn about the product. So we've got a couple of customers who I've introduced, but they weren't familiar with the products and they've mm-hmm. said, look, they look nice, but I don't understand them yet. Give me an opportunity, come and speak to me, do a yeah. bit of education. And we've done that over quite a short period of time. And then they've started placing orders because they understand the product more so they can sell the benefits to their customers. And I think that's kind of the key. So we're here less, I suppose, in a sales role, as you mentioned, and using them as an extension, particularly, you know, with Casiga. We're only quite a small team. There's only 10 of us in the UK. And there's two of us who are sort of the sales team at the moment.
Yeah.
So we are very much reliant on the relationships with distributors and working with them.
Of course, so almost yeah. your salespeople on the ground, I suppose, or your, you know, your
That's
partners.
That's right, yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And do you think projects are more complex now than they were 5-10 years ago?
I think some of the feedback we've had recently from, you know, distributors and consultants is that there perhaps seems to be a bit more in the way of paperwork when it comes to, you know, sustainability.
Yeah.
You know? I don't know in terms of the complexity of designing a kitchen, but certainly delivering and doing their part around, like I say, sustainability and yeah. gathering all that information. And some of the feedback has been it can be a little bit time-consuming and resource-heavy.
More onerous.
Yeah, to collect all that information from different people.
Yeah.
You know, but I think, you know, there are some things being done in the industry to help try and automate, have central places of holding information so that we're not doing it on an ad hoc basis all the time. So I think, you know, whilst things seem to initially be complex, I think people quickly realise we've got to find a solution to this and find ways of reducing complexity.
Yeah, I think some of the complexity comes in the unplannedness of them, certainly from the smaller projects as well.
Mm.
It does seem to be that it's very difficult now to sort of predict, speaking to a lot of distributors, what the workload's going to be like
yes.
for the rest of the year. So a lot of it is there's an opportunity, we've got to take advantage of it.
Yeah.
So everything runs round quite quickly, and I think that's when it becomes tricky, because there's less time to plan it properly, in which case things might spring out of the woodwork that you don't initially
definitely
anticipate.
That people yeah. are holding off for decisions, and then all of a sudden the decision's made and we want it all yesterday.
That's it.
And it's a real fast turnaround.
Yeah, quoting level's quite high just now, and there's a lot of people we're speaking to that are saying, yeah, we're very confident, 90% confident we're going to get the project, but we can't place an order because we don't have the PO.
Yes.
But then suddenly someone says, right, we've got the PO, need it now.
Yeah.
And it's that challenge to help them fulfil it
yeah.
as well.
I guess, and we're not going to get into geopolitics of the world, but that, it leads into that whole geopolitics, instability, mm-hmm. you know, what's happening across the world, that damages confidence, I suppose, leads into that. So
I think it does, and it, you know, affects supply chains going forward as well, potentially. And that's maybe where the energy efficiency thing will start to play more of a part as well, because people will become more conscious about fuel prices as they start to rise.
Yeah.
And certainly we've been... It's not directly related to what you were saying, but certainly we've been seeing an increase in people asking for doors on displays now.
Yeah,
whereas
yeah.
traditionally for the grab and go things, people would say, no, we don't want doors, we want it all open, because if someone has to walk into a shop and or a cafe and get, you know, a can of juice, a bottle of juice, they don't want to have to open a door. It's going to put them off, they'll walk back out again. Mm. There was that perception, whereas I think now people recognise that it's not going to put someone off having to open a door.
Yeah, yeah.
But actually the energy savings that they see, the benefits are worthwhile. So that's why you go into a lot of the supermarkets and a lot of the displays have got doors on them now.
Yeah.
Because it's such a big thing.
It's massive, yeah. particularly on those display cabinets. The energy usage on open multi-decks is insanely high.
Is it?
Yeah, it's enormous. A typical 1,200 wide open multi-deck could be costing £2,500-£3,000 a year in energy.
Wow.
Just to run that one 1,200 wide unit. And of course, when you get condenser blockages and units get older, then that usage goes up. But yeah, by putting doors on products, you know, you're saving 75-80% on energy, and it's huge.
Huge, isn't it?
Absolutely.
It's like a no-brainer.
Yeah, and it's no wonder why you see all the supermarkets now have got doors on, you know, their retail fridges, because they must be saving a fortune in.
The units don't have to work as hard. They keep the temperatures better.
Yeah.
And I guess as a spillover from COVID, there's a little bit of protection as well, because, you know, people aren't sort of together fighting to get things from an open display.
Yeah.
There's a bit of protection there. So,
absolutely.
Okay, well, just to change direction slightly, and obviously we're here today. This podcast is sponsored by Cedar Bond, so we thank them for bringing this together, if you like. And, you know, I mean, maybe you can explain as well, but from my understanding, Cedar Bond is a buying group, if you like, for suppliers and distributors to come together and trade. Is that a fair comment?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a not-for-profit, you know, which is important. You know, they share their profits amongst the members, which, you know, aligns particularly well with us as a business.
Okay.
Around, you know, integrity and so forth. But yeah, it's a community. You know, we're all working towards shared goals and mutual benefit, and you know, ultimately supplying customers with good quality products and so forth. So yeah, it's a really nice community of, you know, like-minded distributors, suppliers, all working together for a common goal.
And Foster, is it also the wider group, all part of Cedar Bond? Is it just Foster, Gamco, or
so Foster and Gamco are part of Cedar Bond. Yep. Foster Cold Stores are also part of Cedar Bond.
Okay.
I'm not sure if Hobart. Okay. I shouldn't comment on that.
For quite a long time.
Yes, we have. Yeah, certainly in the 10 years I've been at Foster and Gamco, we've been involved with Cedar Bond. I know it'll be more than that.
Yeah.
Of course. But yeah, we get great value from it. Yeah, it aligns really well with us as a business. And, you know, ultimately we get the opportunity to, you know, to educate, to support, you know, a community of distributors who are ultimately looking into the group for suppliers. So, you know, ultimately that they get their benefits from, you know, financially around, you know, rebates and payment terms.
And pricing structure and things.
Pricing structure, you know, and we get access to them to promote our products and educate them on features, benefits to then. So we
and I guess for the distributors, you know, if they're dealing with lots of suppliers, it makes their life easier, because they're having to negotiate individual deals with individual manufacturers, that kind of is done.
Yeah.
Which lets them get on with their business.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't think it's about, you know, it's not always about restricting distributors, because ultimately the right product might not be within the group, which I think is accepted, that it's always about supplying the right product to the customer. But yeah, the Cedar Bond network has got a wide range of suppliers that should be able to cater for most needs. So I think it's a group that's served us well over the years, and we get, you know, great benefit from it, and you know, long may it continue.
Yeah, I think they do a really good job as well of talking to distributors and pointing out the benefits and financially that they can gain from doing the job they're doing anyway. So if they're not in Cedar Bond and they don't benefit from the professional terms and the retro, I think it's quite interesting for them. There's a lot of products that are very similar. Mm-hmm. They'll do the same job. But if you can buy them within the group, then the money that you get for a retro at the end for a distributor is great. And then from a manufacturer's point of view, as Lewis said, it's great to be able to get access to all of these people. People are busy. They don't always have time to see you. And I think the way meetings are structured have changed in the last 5 years as well, because lots of people are working from home or they're working remotely. So that's not necessarily the type of job that we would traditionally have done, where you go to someone's office and have a meeting with them. It doesn't quite work so much like that now. So having the Cedar Bond events is a great way to see a lot of people at the same time.
Working and meeting. And
really efficient use of time when everyone's very busy.
I think it's okay for me to say that you're joining, or by the time this podcast is out, you might have joined.
Yes, a bit of a scoop. So we Casiga will be on the Cedar Bond Pavilion, the HRC, having just joined.
Right.
And that was something that I thought was a really important thing to do when I joined the company. I've had experience of Cedar Bond for the last 12, 13 years in the companies I've worked with, and I've really seen the benefit from it. And some of the
was the thought behind that? Is it to access all those distributors in a more easier, not easier, but a structured way, probably?
It is, yeah. I think it's getting access to them. As I mentioned before, we're quite a small team, so it's very difficult for us to try and get around any, you know, we both cover the UK, Jamie and myself, so it's very difficult for us to do that in a manageable way. So this gives us instant access to people. But again, one of the other things we mentioned before is there's a lot of traditional distributors that Kasiga haven't dealt with before, who don't know Kasiga, they don't know the name, they don't know the products, they don't know the benefits from it. So this gives us an immediate platform to get in front of them, where it might be slightly trickier by traditional means. So I think, it's going to be really positive. Some of the customers that I've worked with in the past, I've seen the most growth through Cedarbond as well.
Mm. So I think it's more than just the sort of discounts and the the pricing structure. Obviously, it helps the distributor. Like I said, if you've got suppliers, it makes it easier, doesn't it? But
yeah.
I see they seem to be doing a lot more educational, networking, there's a wider piece going on. Well, HRC Pavilion's a...
There's HRC.
Classic example.
Yeah, but there's all the dealer days as well. So the more local events, which we've participated in the past through other companies, and they've been great. It's just nice to get a smaller number of customers together, and you can spend a little bit of time with them. You can often take product as well. And that's the other thing. If you go to someone's office, it's very rare that you can take, a food display with you to show them and demonstrate it. But if the regional events that they have, it's a great way to do it out with a traditional kind of trade show environment.
And sort of leading on to HRC that's coming up, it still is the biggest food service equipment show in the UK, and obviously part of Hospitality Week, so there's other shows within it at XL. You're exhibiting with the Cedarbond Pavilion.
Yes, that's right. Yeah,
and obviously you'll be there as well.
At
the show as well.
Yes.
What are you looking forward to from HRC? What are you hoping to gain from it, both of you?
I think for us, it's exposure. Try and make it as easy for distributors as possible. And one of the ways to do that is if we can, get in front of end users, sell them the Kasiga dream, as if it were, then they're more likely to then request that through the distributor, which makes the distributor's job much easier. So we're all about passing on leads, passing on inquiries to try and fulfil them. And I think this is a great way to do that, as well as networking with existing customers and new distributors.
Mm.
Yeah, very much the same, in all honesty. It's, for us, it's about catching up with people. Relationships are really important. We know there'll be a lot of people that go, and it can be tricky at times to meet with people for meetings because they're busy with their own roles and projects to deliver, etc. But it's a good chance to see a lot of people, in one place.
Yeah.
And catch up. And of course, you get to see what else is going on in the marketplace, potentially a chance to meet some end users as well. It's often a good time if you've got particular end users you're trying to work with, to invite them down there and take them around and see other things. So, we see great benefit in attending. Whilst we haven't exhibited for a few years, people will still attend.
Yeah, and there's still all the kind of, want of a better word, fringe activities going on.
Yeah.
Upon your Scottish Saturday, but on the Monday night we've got the HRC Cedarbond event, which is like an after hours.
Yes.
I don't know if you saw that.
Yeah.
And that's a networking opportunity. There's more than just a show, isn't there? There's all the activities that go on around it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Nice plug for the event there. Yeah. We'll definitely be attending that.
I bought my ticket. Yeah. I had to buy one.
You should have said. Okay.
So we're looking forward to that and catching up with fellow Cedarbond members.
I mean, do you think these shows, obviously, it's difficult because obviously, if we look at Host Milan, that is like the show of all shows, isn't it? I mean, that is just like off the scale in size. But do you think these shows, these trade shows, have still got a place in the UK?
I think they do. I mean, I've got a soft spot for them from previously, having, you know, organised events. And I really think there's, if you can take product, we won't have any product with us for the HRC Cedarbourne Pavilion. But if you can take product, it's much easier for customers to actually touch and feel things. But less people, distributors have got showrooms now.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of the equipment, it's high value. Personally, I don't really want to buy something that's high value just looking at a digital image on a screen or looking at a brochure. I would rather touch it and open the door and close it and look at the back and get a better feeling for that. So I think it gives people more of an opportunity
to do that. Yeah.
And beyond that, just, you know, for distributors and suppliers and consultants in the industry, it's almost just like a big meeting room as well, isn't it? So it's a meeting venue.
Yeah.
It just happens to be that there's some product there.
Yeah, I do remember one of the first things I did when I joined Foster & Gangco was spend 5 days at what I think it was still would have been Hotel Olympia.
Yeah.
Back then, and
that's when it was 5 days. That was a killer.
I can still feel the pain on my feet now. I made a bad choice of footwear for those 5 days, and I learned the hard way. I think by day five, I was just sat in a cold room on the stand, just kind of resting my feet in there. But yeah, no, I remember going to that and thinking, oh, what a great event, and the amount of people that you would talk to, and for me being new, meet a lot of people as well. Mm. And yeah, of course, you know, I think just the growth of online now has just meant a lot of information is available, you know, online webinars, etc. has kind of naturally meant that these shows maybe have got a bit smaller and less people are exhibiting, but there's still great value to be had from seeing people, connecting with people, meeting new people. You know, those things will never go away, and these kind of shows are still really relevant for us.
I think that, you know, and maybe I might say, as you know, I'm an ambassador for HRC, so I might say this, but from my side of being involved in those meetings and talking to them over the last year, they really seem to have got it, as I see.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this year is going to be a lot better than last year. It's not, we're not going to, you know, jump 10 years. You know, it's going to take time over years to build it. But I see there's been a lot of work going on. Things like the Cedarbourne Pavilion, making it more accessible for smaller manufacturers to have a stand. Those are those opportunities, FEA Pavilion, you know, the skill, the Salon Conair, all of those kind of things. So I think we tend to get boxed into the equipment bit, but actually there's a wider industry attending there that,
I mean, I quite like looking out for the, you know, the end users that speak and talk about their challenges.
Exactly,
what
seminars.
They're seeing and, you know, because that's really...
It's an educational piece.
Yeah, it is. It's really useful for us to understand, you know, what's their priorities, you know, and off the back of that, we can then, you know, it goes into the thought pot for new products, et cetera. And, you know, there's been some great speakers over the years, some really, you know, some great presenters. And, you know, that's one of the other reasons I go to HRC is to look out for those talks. And
it's not the equipment support, but it's not just about the equipment, it's also about that wider, if it all goes wrong, we can go to the pub bit and, you know,
just go in the pub snack section and just sample some
and that's well, we're nearly coming to the end of the podcast, so you'll be relieved to hear you made it almost to the end.
It's been a pleasure.
We're just going to do a quick fire round and then we'll wrap it up if that's okay. So just short answers for me, and I'll just for both of you. So early mornings or late nights?
Early mornings now with the kids, so up at 6:30 every day to get them ready for school before I go to work.
Both for me, really.
Okay.
Three young children that don't go to sleep, and then up in the morning as well, so
the best of both worlds.
Exactly, yeah.
Tea, coffee?
Decaf tea now.
Okay.
Honest, yeah, I think I'm just getting to that age.
Black coffee for me.
Right. Okay. Guilty food pleasure, like what, you know, if Mackey's or what, I don't know, whatever.
my wife and my kids call them stinky crisps, but the red Doritos.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know why, but I love those.
I don't know if it's a guilty food, but I've really come to appreciate, do you know those Charlie Bingham ready meals?
Oh, yeah.
They are fantastic.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Yeah, they, I mean, we'd all get a takeaway maybe once a month or so, but yeah, we just thought, let's try.
Especially in a rush, they're great to pop in the oven, job done.
Great, mm-hmm. Half an hour, and yeah, it's real fresh, nice ingredients. Yeah,
your answer sounds much more sophisticated than mine.
don't get me wrong, there's a whole host of other things, you know, Haribo sours or something. But
best city in the world for food.
Can I give you a slightly different answer?
Yeah.
I would say best county for food is Norfolk.
Okay.
I think it's a real hidden gem in the UK, Norfolk. I think people naturally gravitate towards Cornwall or the Lake District or something like that. But Norfolk is fantastic. So many lovely little market towns, Michelin-starred restaurants, local produce. We're just about to release a feature called Chef's Corner at Foster, where we interview and get quite close to local chefs in Norfolk and talk to them. So there's some real great chefs that we've got on there. So if anyone's planning to go on holiday to Norfolk, have a little look at that, because there's some great suggestions around where to
eat. Last August bank holiday, I went to the North Norfolk Food Festival.
Yeah.
It was amazing.
Yeah.
Like, it was absolutely fantastic. I couldn't even believe it. People told me that part was like called Chelsea by the Sea, or I don't know what it is, but...
There's Wells next to the sea.
That's it, yeah.
Holt near Cromer. I don't know if you've ever been there. Yeah. That's a stunning place.
I came back with like Norfolk rum, Norfolk gin, jams, pickles, all sorts of things. So
It's, you've got a lot of produce that finds its way into the parts of the UK comes from Norfolk. You know, there's a lot of agriculture there, and near the sea for fish and so forth. So Norfolk for me.
Yeah, cool. I like that.
A tricky one, to be honest. I think I live in Chester now, and there's some great places to eat in Chester, but Edinburgh is good as well.
Okay,
it's good for a night out.
Kept it in the UK.
Yes.
I thought it would sound too extravagant.
I had
Sydney's very nice.
I had Bangkok, I had like three or four episodes that people, it was Bangkok, and then London and the usual. Okay. Well, thank you both for joining me here in the studio on this Wednesday in London. I hope you enjoyed it.
No, thanks for having us. Really enjoyed it.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks for your time.
And obviously, I will see you both at HRC in less than a couple of weeks' time,
Absolutely. Looking forward to it.
Yeah.
See you there.
Forward to that.
Definitely. Thanks very much.
Okay. Well, that concludes this episode of Kitchen Curiosity. And as we heard there, we've talked a lot about projects and Ewan and Lewis's careers and how they got into the sector, and a little bit on sustainability. And we talked a bit about HRC, part of Hospitality Week, which a big trade show on XL from the 30th of March till the 1st of April. So we hope to see you there. On the next episode, we're going to sit down with Specify and discussing around their software solution they bring to the food service equipment market and a new addition they've got coming out. If you've got any questions, please email me at radford@kitchencurosity.co.uk. If you've got time, please rate the podcast. And I'm happy to say that we've just almost at 25,000 listeners now in 62 countries. So that's quite an achievement, really. So thank you to everyone that's been involved and everyone that listens. I've been your host, Radford Chancellor, and you've been listening to Kitchen Curiosity.
Kitchen Curiosity is written and hosted by Radford Chancellor and is edited and produced by Tom Anderson. Kitchen Curiosity is a Sound Rebel production.